It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Trump administration announced layoffs on Friday for parts of the Department of Education, which included offices responsible for overseeing special education.
The Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services administers programs that support students with disabilities, and it monitors states to make sure they comply with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act.
The reduction in workforce comes just weeks after the Trump administration cut funding for Wisconsin grant that supports the recruiting and development of special education teachers.
The Trump administration has said that these changes are part of a wider effort to turn education over to states. We're checking in on what these layoffs and cuts mean for special education in the state.
There are still some open questions about the legality of the layoffs. Heidi Siebert is Director of Special Education for Cooperative Educational Service Agency No. 7, known as CESA 7, also an education partner for the Wisconsin Special Education Mediation System. Heidi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you delve into for us what this Federal Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services does, especially when it comes to special education here in Wisconsin?
Wow. Well, overall, OSERS and OSEP, they oversee the state implementation of the provisions of IDEA. So if people don't know what IDEA is, that's the federal law. It's the 50th anniversary, 1975. It was first passed, the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, which is a federal law that establishes the rights of students with disabilities and their families to be provided with a free, appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. It oversees the development of IEPs. And then where I come in as part of the mediation system is the rights of students and parents when there's disputes that arise. And so these layoffs coupled with the other cuts that have been made could potentially be devastating to the oversight and the ability of parents and schools to get remedy when things arise.
Right. That's part of these layoffs, the people that a parent might go to at the federal level to say, hey, Wisconsin's dropping the ball on implementing this IDEA Act for my kid. That's part of what's going away. Do I have that right?
Well, it could. I mean, when you look at what has been put out, that there might be two people left to manage a department that used to be almost 500. They not only oversee the compliance of states like Wisconsin and all of our states, but also the budget. And we have to apply every year for IDEA funds, flow through funds to help support our students with disabilities, where state and local funding, it makes up where they fall short.
The argument for this and some other changes in the education department in general from the Trump administration is, hey, we want a lighter federal footprint. We're going to let the states take more responsibility for handling these kind of things. Can Wisconsin just step up and do what the federal government has been doing when it comes to special education?
Well, Wisconsin already does. I'm proud. I'm starting my 25th year in special education in Wisconsin. And just to give a little history lesson, Chapter 115, our special ed law for the state of Wisconsin, was actually passed 2 years before IDEA. So Wisconsin has always had a commitment to our students with disabilities and our families. However, this is a federal law. It's a civil rights law. And so while Wisconsin might step up, what about the other students? 7.5 million students in our country that have disabilities. And so it's not just, I'm not worried about Wisconsin, but I am worried about each and every student across the country.
Something that may hit a little closer to home. We mentioned that grant funding cut just a few weeks back, I think, from the Trump administration that went to special education teacher training and recruitment in the state. What was that funding being used for?
Oh, that was a huge blow to us. I actually, as part of my role at CESA 7, I oversee the grant. It's called the Wisconsin Attracting and Retaining Special Education Induction Program. And while we can still do our first year teachers, it was a blow to our second and third year teachers, supporting them in their roles. We know based on research and data in Wisconsin that only 55% of teachers remain after 7 years. And it's even higher or lower for special ed teachers. And so this was devastating. Again, Wisconsin stepped up and filled that gap for most of the parts, but we still had the Whitewater program, the residency and teacher residency program cut, and some other modules and basically work to get the word out about how great it is to be a special educator and how needy we are in that area to support our students with disabilities.
How needy are we in this area? Are schools having trouble hiring and then retaining special education teachers?
Absolutely. Right now, I think we have over 300 in our program across the state, brand new special ed teachers. And where maybe 20 years ago, a lot of them were coming out of traditional programs, they're not anymore. We're recruiting out of all walks of life to become teachers, all teachers. We have a shortage, but specifically in special education. And the irony of this, to some regard, is we have this crisis of autism, let's say, that has been brought up, that we have to do more and we have to figure autism out while also cutting the very people on the ground that are supporting our students with autism. And so, yeah, it's crisis level.
Heidi, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Heidi Siebert, Director of Special Education for CESA 7, with us today to share how Trump administration cuts and layoffs in the Department of Education could affect special education here in Wisconsin. Now we turn our attention to the experiences of people with disabilities in Wisconsin and how the special education system affects them. Sydney Badeau is chair of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Sydney, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you heard about these federal cuts to departments that oversee special education law?
Yeah, my first reaction was that it is going to be devastating for kids who are in special education, receiving special education services, especially if things aren't followed through with IEPs or accommodations that need to happen, and they don't have anyone at the federal level to go to.
And I understand you have a personal experience with special education support in schools. Can you share some of your story and how that affected your education?
Sure. I was in special education from kindergarten through my senior year in high school. It affected my education by being able to have the proper accommodations needed to succeed. I had accommodations to allow me to be in regular education classes and do the same work as my peers, but sometimes my work was modified so that it was easier. And today I also work for two nonprofit organizations, as well as being chair for the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. And part of that is due to the great work that was done when I was in special education.
What would your school experience have been like, do you think, without that support, or if there had been less support or fewer teachers available?
If I had less support or if there was fewer teachers available, I think that I would not have had the same experience growing up in school. And I probably wouldn't have been able to have the same experience as I had and getting the same quality education to be where I'm at today.
What kind of power do parents and guardians have to advocate for their child's educational needs and those individualized education plans? What can parents do, caregivers do, to advocate for their kids who need these kind of supports?
Sure. Caregivers or parents can advocate for their kids who need this kind of supports by contacting their school superintendent, or they can contact their legislators, especially contacting the congressional representatives in their district so that they know what's going on and how the cuts at the special education level are impacting the students, because they don't know what's happening unless people let them know.
We just heard from Heidi Siebert with CISA 7, that she made the case that Wisconsin, compared to other states, does pretty well with providing special education services. From your perspective, do you think Wisconsin is doing a pretty good job? Where might there be room for improvement?
I do think Wisconsin is doing a pretty good job. I'm not sure where there can be room for improvement right now.
We also heard from Heidi about the need for special education teachers, and part of what she does is try to make the case for teachers to consider special education. If you had a chance to talk to the teachers of the future, Sydney, what would you say about the value of going into special education?
Yeah. So the value of going into special education would be the impact of improving the lives of kids with disabilities, because everybody has the opportunity to succeed. They just might need some accommodations or modifications to how they learn, so that way they can be the best student that they can possibly be. Because sometimes accommodations make the world of difference.
Sydney, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Sydney Bedeau, chair of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She was with us today to share her experience receiving special education support. Earlier, we heard from CISA 7 Director of Special Education, Heidi Siebert, about how Department of Education layoffs could impact special education in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you. Is this an issue that affects you or a loved one, a family member, or maybe students of yours if you are in education? Are you concerned about the future of support at the federal level for special education programs and enforcement of civil rights law when it comes to people with disabilities in schools? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org with your concerns, maybe your experiences. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, credit scores have dropped on average for Americans, with younger adults facing the biggest declines. Find out what's driving that trend and get some advice on how and why to boost your credit score.
The cost of access to credit will cost you so much over time that you could be taking money away from yourself for retirement.
That's next on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New data from the company FICO shows that national average credit scores dropped for the second consecutive year and at the quickest pace since the Great Recession.
The report finds that Gen Z borrowers experienced the sharpest average credit score drop of any age group. FICO found that an increasing share of borrowers are behind on credit card, car, and personal loans.
However, credit scores do remain higher than they were during the Great Recession. And not all borrowers are feeling the pinch, as some consumers are benefiting from all-time highs in the stock market and rising home values.
Jay Michael Collins joins us for a look at what these numbers mean for consumers in Wisconsin. He's a professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
We've got this report from FICO finding a national average credit score going down for the second year in a row, biggest drop since the Great Recession. What do you see behind that decline in our average creditworthiness?
Yeah, I mean, we still have COVID, right? So I think that's part of what we're seeing is that there was this huge shock, really, to all households and you know, everybody's credit around COVID. And so initially that was pretty negative. And then coming out of COVID, there were lots of subsidies and many creditors actually gave some reprieve for borrowers. And so that shock is really kind of still rippling through what we see in the credit reports and the credit histories, which FICO uses to compose their credit scores. And, you know, especially we're seeing the end of the student loan hiatus on payments. And so that's, I think that's what's driving a lot of this.
With our next guest, we're going to dig into what FICO means for us as individuals. What does it mean to you as an economic indicator, right? As one of the various tea leaves we can read on how people are doing in our economy?
You know, we care a lot about credit. I mean, those of us who went through the 2008 recession know how devastating consumer credit can be for the overall economy. In that case, it was mortgage debt. But we worry about households really getting in over their skis, so to speak, where they cannot keep up with their debt loads. And so in many ways, what the FICO score does is it's a combination of how much we're using debt, how reliant we are on debt, and then also how good we are at repaying that collectively. And those scores are just a way for, you know, particularly lenders to sum up what that behavior looks like. And, you know, it does provide a general indicator of where things are at. I have to say, though, scores are still quite high. So we have concerns, but, you know, relative to the grand scope of the last 20 years, they do actually look pretty good.
As people dig into the numbers, and if I understand it correctly, this isn't, okay, we've gone down a couple points because everybody has gone down a couple points. We have a little bit of hollowing out of the middle and a split where some people are doing fine and their FICO scores are going up. And then we've got a chunk of the population where they're going down a little more. What do you make of that? How significant is that, especially for those people who are seeing the scores go down?
Yeah, I mean, if you're experiencing them going down, you're aware of this, and you know, you probably are doing everything you can to avoid it. But you know, it's a combination of not being able to keep up with payments and taking out an increasing amount of debt. Those are kind of the big drivers of this. You know, I think it tells us that they're definitely, I think the report itself describes this sort of K shape in terms of what the economy looks like. But for people who are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, who have some debt, who don't have any emergency savings and don't have a lot of cushion, it really is a pretty delicate balance trying to keep up with payments, you know, occasionally letting some things slide here and there. It's really just doing the best you can. And they, you know, probably don't have a lot of other options in that case. And so I think that's what we're seeing for, you know, especially for low wage workers, for people who have unstable hours, and just, you know, trying to keep up with those payments becomes a little bit too much.
Some of the analysis I've seen says, hey, this is mainly a concern among younger adults, Generation Z, the Gen Alpha, if that's what we're calling them, as they start to come out of school. What are you seeing for younger people in particular?
For sure, we have the most concerns about that, say, 18 to 29, under 30 age group. But that said, we always have a concern about that age group. So they're always the group that is the, you know, most likely to miss an auto loan, for example, or the most likely to miss a credit card loan, for example. So it's always a group that struggles with their credit. It's part of being a young adult and adjusting to, you know, the adulting of managing credit. Also, they're just more likely to have instability in their employment. They're trying to juggle maybe starting a family or going to school. And so all those things make it a riskier population. I think what's different now is the role of student debt. And the report brings this out that, you know, this is a group that has more student debt. And particularly because, again, of the pandemic and what we saw in that sort of shock to student loans where they weren't due for a while, then they were due. And then there's this long on-ramp of when they're due and how they're due, a ton of confusion that people have about how to manage these. And so I think that student loan debt just adds another wrinkle that's especially important for that under 30 age group.
I'm not sure how the timing of this would correlate to this FICO report. We're seeing concerns in recent months now for those younger workers that employers are sitting tight on hiring. They're maybe not laying a lot of people off. They're not hiring new people. And that's kind of leading to a stall in the labor market for new college graduates, even in some cases for new high school graduates. What do you watch for that younger workforce as they're trying to get established and, you know, hopefully pay these bills regularly?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right. So there is some stagnation in hiring. I think it also trickles to those people in their even mid-20s who are employed but would like to jump to the next job, maybe a better paying job, maybe get a promotion. Those aren't happening either. So it's not just on the entry to the labor market. It's also movement within the labor market. There's just not a lot of opportunities to, you know, interview for a different job to perhaps get a raise. And so all of that creates a lot of pressure. Meanwhile, there's been no reprieve on what the cost of housing are, for example, or for the other costs that people face.
You mentioned earlier, yes, these FICO scores have gone down for a couple of years, but in the scope of things, they're pretty good. I don't want to be a negative media guy and only focus on that bad news. What led these credit scores to be up at a pretty good level in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, let's say to have, like going back to the Great Recession. So in the Great Recession, all credit really was not looking good. I mean, from 2008 to 2013 was a pretty rough period for delinquencies and, you know, for people being able to take out debt. So, you know, that was really a long recovery coming out of the Great Recession. And just before the pandemic, people were actually doing pretty well. And then the pandemic, you know, really a lot of people used the, if they were in pretty good shape in terms of their employment, they were able to use the pandemic and use some of these reprieves from payments to catch up, to pay off some debt, to build some savings. And the result, people have come out of the, you know, the average consumer has come out of the pandemic with pretty good balance sheets, pretty good credit, but now that's wearing off. And so I think what we're seeing now is back to a normalization of the, you know, or 2017, 18, 19 kind of period, kind of going back to that, but, you know, still trying to recover from the shock, especially on the student loan side.
You mentioned delinquency, and a FICO analyst in this report noted, I'm going to quote a little bit here, bear with me, delinquency rates on auto loans, credit cards, and personal loans are at or near their highest levels since 2009 during the Great Recession and are more consistent with an economy in recession than one still in expansion. That's the end of the quote here. Delinquency rates on loans, how worried should we be about that if this is at a larger scale since we've seen since the Great Recession?
Yeah, honestly, that's the thing to focus the most on, even more than the FICO scores themselves, is the delinquencies. You know, if you look at the delinquency rate for student loans, it's just like, you know, they call it a hockey stick. It's just straight up, right? And so there's a real shock that people are facing in managing their credit. I mean, we're not seeing anything close to the worrying levels of mortgage delinquencies that we saw back in 2008, but the credit card delinquencies are getting soft. The auto loan delinquencies, I think we're, you know, there's some worries to be had. And, you know, maybe you don't have any of these loans, so you say, well, it doesn't affect me. It might affect your financial institution. You know, it might affect the ability of a lender who wants to make, who maybe doesn't want to make that next loan to you because they don't want to take that risk. So it does affect all of us, even if we're not currently in these credit markets.
One of the things going on in 2008 before the Great Recession is Americans were pretty over-leveraged with debt, whether we're talking about a lot of our financial and investment and mortgage companies to people who had been encouraged to take out loans, buy more property, you're going to make money on it. Do you have a sense that we have too much loan debt that might leave the economy as a whole vulnerable?
I think if you ask, you know, four different economists, you'll get four different opinions on what too much debt is. It's challenging. I think, you know, sometimes there's this reference to sort of good debt and bad debt. You know, good debt is to buy a mortgage or a mortgage to buy a house, and bad debt is a credit card. You know, the reality is people are just doing the best they can, trying to juggle their income and expenses, trying to smooth out whatever their needs are over time. And so, you know, obviously when people borrowed more than their homes were worth during the Great Recession, that was really bad. I don't think we're quite seeing that now. Even on auto loans, people who are buying used auto loans and maybe worried about the fact that the car is not worth what the loan is, it's a pretty small share of the overall market. So, you know, we obviously have to watch the student loan market really carefully and watch credit cards really carefully, but it doesn't seem to me quite at the level of we saw, say, 15 years ago.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Appreciate it.
J. Michael Collins is a professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison. For more on what people can do if they take a ding to their credit scores, we've got Preston Cherry with us, assistant professor of finance and personal financial planning at UW-Green Bay, director there of the Charles Schwab Center for Personal Financial Planning, founder and president of Concurrent Financial Planning, author of the book Wealth in the Key of Life. Preston, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. First of all, how concerned should people be about their FICO scores?
They should be concerned. You know, you don't need, people always say, well, credit scores are not needed anymore. And I don't think that's true, because you need credit, and you don't need credit until you need it. You can't save enough assets. You can't save enough assets out of credit until you need it. And what do I mean by that? Well, until you're like 50 or 60, and then you have these wealth of portfolio assets to where you don't have to borrow anymore, well, then you may not need credit. And even at that, these business owners, they still have to borrow to fund their businesses. You may have a second vacation home that you need. So wherever you are in your life phase, credit, access to credit is still important. So credit scores are very important no matter where you are in your life stage.
And my credit score could impact whether I get a loan, right? But in some cases, as I understand it, it could affect the interest rate I pay on the loan. So a lower FICO score, even if I can get credit, might cost me money over time. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. The cost of capital is very important. I share with the young folks that I teach all the time is that the classes that they take at the university, particularly personal finance, will pay for itself tremendously over their lifetime. And what do I mean? Well, if you abuse your credit very early, well, the cost of access to credit will cost you so much over time that you could be taking money away from yourself for retirement or the lifestyle that you want to live, because the auto rate that you're trying to get, it can be right now they're in the sevens. It could be 10. The home rate that you're trying to get, it's 6% right now. It could turn into 8, 9, or 10. And that could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars over a lifetime. And we already have a shortcoming of retirement preparedness across all generations. So if your cost of credit is high, it's taken away from lifestyles and also retirement preparedness.
Now, in this FICO report that started this conversation, they mentioned they're seeing some borrowers prioritizing different pieces of their debt. If they've got, say, car loans, student loans, auto loans, house loans, whatever, doing kind of a triage. So for that person out there, they've got different types of debt. They can't afford, obviously, to pay them all down. Maybe they can keep minimum payments on a couple, but they could start chipping away at one. What do you recommend prioritizing if they're in that situation?
Well, there's many ways to do it. I mean, we've heard about the snowball effect where you are attacking the most high interest debt that you have and then attacking that one with all your might and then paying the minimums on the rest. And then once you pay down or pay off one, then you attack the next high interest one while paying the minimums and keeping on repeating that pattern. You can also take the smallest debt that you have and pay that off quick. And that way you can take that amount that you have and apply that one to perhaps the next smallest one. So you can take a bottom-up approach and use the principal's amounts that you pay off quickly and use to the next one, or you can use that snowball effect and use that that high interest approach and pay the minimums on the rest. So those are two ways to address it. I will say this, paying off your debt and then not addressing your savings and investing, that's not one way to go. Because some folks say, okay, just power down and pay off debt and then don't do any saving and investing during that time. And I don't really subscribe to that one. I think you should still save for retirement or do some future-based savings while you're paying down your debt.
That's interesting because I think it's easy for people to look at this debt they owe right now. Right. And that's occupying all their brain space when it comes to money. How can they in that situation start setting aside even a little bit for a Roth IRA or what have you?
Well, and I don't like the word should, too. I know I just put that out there, but it's more psychological, too, because I would say I want to affirm folks' emotions, because the psychology of money is very important, because debt can be very worry-driven, anxiety-driven, and also maybe have some guilt, some regret, and some shame. So folks, it's preference based. So folks want to say, okay, I don't want any debt anymore. So they want to just power down and go ahead and pay that down. And that's fine, actually. So if they want to take that approach, that's fine, because that's a preference. That said, if you have some bandwidth in your budget, then say, for example, a 401k, you have a match program in your 401k more than likely. So your place of employment is giving you a match on your money, and it's quote unquote free money. And I like to say that's not free money. That's actually your money that you're leaving on the table. Right. So at the very minimum, contribute enough to the 401k to where you're receiving your match, and then still simultaneously go aggressive on your debt payment.
Now, for FICO scores, if people are worried, hey, my score is low, that might hurt me down the road, give us a behavior that's going to help that score. Give us a behavior that's going to hurt that score, please.
Well, I think automation is one behavior that you can subscribe to, and which is if you don't see it, then you can't spend it. And automating an amount to where you are, well, one, prioritize the debt repayment. And that means, you know, admitting that there is an issue that you need to address. Avoidance is the compounding effect, and it's only going to get worse. And I know that it's hard to admit sometimes that there is a problem, and putting the head in the sand may seem that it's just simply going to go away, or that you don't have to deal with it. It's only going to make the problem worse. So admitting, number one, that's a behavioral aspect. Number two, taking some action and automating the process and say, put a timeline and amount to the issue, and then automate that over time. Say I want to be out of debt on this particular credit card, for example, in 18 or 24 months. What amount does that take? And then automate that, and that way you have a mental and also an emotional aspect and a financial number to know when that debt is going to be reduced.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Preston Sherry is an assistant professor of finance and director of the Charles Schwab Center for Personal Financial Planning at UW-Green Bay and founder and president of Concurrent Financial Planning. He offers advice on YouTube and elsewhere under the username Dr. Preston Sherry. We also heard from J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison, been talking about our personal finances as a credit score report from FICO, as in the FICO score, says, hey, our numbers have gone down, particularly for younger Americans.
Still ahead, the World Street Fishing Championship is coming to the Fox River in Green Bay. Hear from members of Team USA on this fast-growing sport among anglers who cast a line from shore.
You're standing on the shoreline, no boats, no electronics. Nearly everything you can catch with an artificial bait counts.
Street fishing in Wisconsin, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Green Bay is set to host the Street Fishing World Championship that opens with a Parade of Nations ceremony a week from today.
10 teams from across the globe will compete in this fast-growing sport among anglers in urban areas who cast their lines from shore. We'll hear from Team USA in just a bit.
But first, Wisconsin Today producer Beatrice Lawrence went out to talk with some anglers in Madison to find out what they like about fishing in the city.
Here's Ling Yang, who is fishing off the train tracks on Lake Monona.
I was born in Thailand, but grew up here in Madison, so, oh no, stuck in the weeds. My dad teaching me how to fish all the way from when I was a little kid. First spot I started learning was at the zoo at Lake Winger over there. Yeah. And then started learning everywhere else, the rivers and bigger lakes like this. It's closer to home, definitely, so I don't have to drive too far for gas-wise, but, and I mean, every now and then you get nice big fishes too, which is nice, but I've been able to get my nephew over there to start fishing, but I've been trying to teach like all my younger nephews and everyone too, but I guess overall it's just good like life lessons. I mean, learning fishing is like a good patient testing, like why it's like, you know, because you do need a lot of patience for fishing, because if you don't, then you're not going to get any fish.
Right. Yeah. My name is Charles Grady, and I'm from Milwaukee. I fish all over. Fish Beaver Dam for catfish and crappies, also fish other places. All right, the cities, you don't have far to go. Madison here is a little different. You have to use a different jig, like a lead head jig, small one. Like on the outlying area, like those lakes, you get away from that and you use artificial. and mostly minnows and not so much panfish unless you're in a boat.
Ryan Johnson from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Guy in the blue shirt down there. Okay. He's a Vietnam veteran. He always take me fishing.
Can I get your
this
name?
This is Mike Spencer. You know, I'm here with some friends, so they may want to keep the probably some bluegills is what we have been catching so far. At least I only caught one, but sure. Yeah. So, you know, I know there's some notifications along here about keeping the fish, I think. Mm-hmm. But basically it's just for the fun of it. Yeah. I just enjoy getting out wherever, in the city or in the country or, yeah.
James Bartels, okay. This is my honey hole. Every fall you'll find me up here. Well, the traffic's pretty heavy, but once I get up here and at this time of year, I know I'm gonna have luck. Cause I can just tell the temperatures are dropping and they're moving in here. They're packing in like thieves. I eat them, otherwise I wouldn't be up here catching them. But I get the impression that eventually they don't want fish in here. It's okay to come flying through with your nice boats, you know, but yeah. Not everybody has a boat. Not everyone has a boat. You got no choice, you know, on a weekend, bring your kids out. I grew up fishing this area with my Uncle Ed, right under here for crappies. But I got smart, I figured out the bluegill technique.
Now, for a look at street fishing at the elite level, we're joined by two members of the USA street fishing team. Lee Young of Green Bay is a competitor and coach. He's president of U.S. Angling's street fishing discipline. And Chris Ledvina of Shano is also a competitor and coach. He's incoming president for U.S. Angling when Lee retires next year. Chris and Lee, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Welcome to street fishing.
Indeed. Lee, starting with you, as a sport, how is street fishing different from other types of ways that anglers catch fish?
Yeah, it's a funny name, street fishing. What it basically means is urban shoreline artificial baits fishing. So you're standing on the shoreline, no boats, no electronics. Nearly everything you can catch with an artificial bait counts. It's measured and securely, safely released, uploaded to an app. Longest total number of fish generally wins the event.
Chris, have you explored artificial baits and experimented with them?
Oh, 100%. You know, every time on the water, we're constantly trying different baits, different techniques, especially now with the changing seasons. That makes it more of an interesting battle with the colder weather, and the fish start getting lethargic and going into winter patterns, fall patterns. So we're constantly trying to dial in our artificial lures, trying to get these fish figured out. So
Lee, you and all of the members of the U.S. street fishing team all hail from Wisconsin, it looks like. Why does our state dominate?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First reason is upper Midwest urban. So city, town fishing, we have a lot of opportunities. There are a lot of anglers who grab a rod, net, box of lures, go out on the street to their nearest canal or their nearest city river and fish. So we do have a lot of people who do that. Second reason is we're a new and growing discipline for U.S. angling. So we don't have a lot of money. So we couldn't really go visit every angler who wants to fish for the USA team in every part of the US. We'd spend thousands of dollars traveling around. And if we did select those anglers, they then need to spend thousands of dollars coming up to us to fish with us to be a part of an actual team. It's not individual fishing. All the anglers will fish as two pairs for their nation. Because it's fishing as pairs, you really have to get to know each other and be able to just react and relate without having to spend time on words.
And then in this championship, Lee, what makes a good teammate?
Well, my teammate's the best. He's quiet when I need him to be, very noisy when he's caught a fish and I need to know, because the pair angler who hasn't caught a fish has to immediately help net and look after the fish. Because it's all about fish safety and their welfare. So I need to know when Eric hooks up a fish. Very, very good at what he does, and he complements my skills and experience. and being a local Wisconsin boy rather than me an implant, his experiences are very different from mine.
Chris, how about you? What makes a good partner here?
Well, my partner is Adam, and we work well together because he's a finesse fisherman and I'm a power fisherman, meaning he uses real slow, delicate techniques, and I run through there and I try to bomb them as quick as I can and catch them right away, you know. So we work well together as a team, and that's why we complement each other so well. So that's what works good for us.
Chris, how did you get hooked, so to speak? You're in Shano, from what I understand.
Correct. Well, from an early age, ever since I was younger, in high school, middle school, pedaling my bike, fishing streams, fishing from shore, that's what I've been doing, and that's what I really enjoy, because you can kind of get off the beaten track, get away from people, and find your own little niche, and it's pretty relaxing and pretty fun. So, you know, from a young age, I've been doing it ever since, and it's a lot of fishing is overlooked from the shore. Everybody's got a boat these days, and they want to go out and use their electronics, where we go on the shore, and we kind of do our own thing. So it's kind of a fun situation, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
A little bit lower tech, it sounds like.
Correct. And this makes you actually a better fisherman without the electronics. So now, instead of the fish finder saying, oh, the fish are here, we got to use our skills and find where the fish are and then make them bite. So it's a little more of a challenge, and I like the challenge.
Chris, so there are two training days on the calendar of this championship. What happens on the training days?
Well, we do one of two things. Either we got it figured out and we just try some off-the-wall techniques, or we're going to still be casting our things that we think are going to be working and trying to figure more patterns out. So it's like Lee always says, it's smoke and mirrors, you know? So we don't know exactly what we're going to do on our practice days yet. We're going to kind of let the weather decide what we're going to do with that. But, you know, so if you're watching us, you ain't going to really know if we're really fishing or if we're just playing with you guys. So it's going to be interesting.
Oh, my goodness, Lee, it sounds like there are some tactics to be had on these training days, a little bit of bluff here and there.
Yeah, it's highly tactical. Last year, we were in Peschiera Delgada in Italy for the World Championship. I have friends in the English team. They obviously made a special point of making sure that I only saw the stuff they would not use during the World Championship.
Oh.
It didn't fool me, but I still didn't know exactly what their tactics were going to be. And I made the wrong tactical decision, as it turned out, and they made the right one. They got silver medal and nearly won the World Championships. So I'm hoping that this year I will, in a nice way, in a friendly, competitive way, turn the tables on them. And we will show them during the training days and the practice days everything that we're not going to use. And then, as Chris said, on the day we'll switch it up and hopefully we'll catch a few big fish early. And
this is like a whole other, yeah, it's a whole other facet of this discipline that I had no idea.
Yeah, well, one of the great things about it is, because we're fishing from the shoreline, anyone who wants to come along and see us can literally walk straight up to us. And as long as they're respectful distance, so we don't hook an ear or a nose, you know, they can be part of the action. They can see the world's best artificial baits anglers on the shoreline next to them catching fish, or failing to catch fish, I suppose, if it's going to be really hard. We don't know what the weather's going to do to us. We don't know how the fish are going to respond. They can't tell us what they like. We have to ring the changes and present them something they like to eat, and then we'll see how that works. The great thing is the spectators get to see all of that.
We are talking with two members of the USA Street Fishing Team, Lee Young of Green Bay and Chris Ledvina of Shano is here. And they'll be competing in the 2025 Street Fishing World Championships at sites along the Fox River in Green Bay and surrounding communities later this month. Lee, I think you mentioned, you know, this street fishing discipline, it's relatively new. Where is the sport headed?
It's at this moment the fastest growing competitive angling discipline in the world. So what happened after the pandemic? People were allowed out of their lockdowns around the world, But they weren't necessarily allowed to travel long distances. So they ended up fishing their local community waters, their park lake or their park river in their cities. And it kind of grew up from that. Groups of anglers got together and competed against each other. Fast forward about 5-6 years, and it's a very rapidly growing sport. We actually have two new nations coming this year that weren't at the last three World Championships. And the Streak Fishing World Championships has only been run for 4 years. This is the fourth event. So this year we have the Philippines sending a team to Green Bay and the Pier. We have the Benin Republic in West Africa sending a team. It's going to be interesting to see what they need to do to cope and how they're going to make the fishing happen for them. And obviously, we want to welcome them, and we hope they do well. And we'll give them all the help and support we can, because they're just like us 2 years ago. You know, when Chris and I went to Mantua in Italy for the second World Championships in 2023, we were just like the Philippines and Benin this month. We didn't know what to expect. We were a bit of a wild card. We just had to try and figure it out during the practice sessions.
So, you know, Chris, someone comes up to you as you're in the championship and as they check out what you're doing, what is your best Wisconsin street fishing advice to other anglers who want to try this out?
My best advice is, if you're getting into the sport, I always tell people to go to your local bait shop, talk to them. They're more than willing to help you out, send you in the right direction, tell you what's going on, tell you what they're biting, and set you up the correct way so you don't go out there and fail right away. You know, that way you can get all the information you need to know before you go out there and be like, oh, this fishing sucks because I don't have the right tools for it. You know, so that's my best advice. I tell people, just go to your local bait shop and then talk to them, and they can point you in the right direction. You know, and we're more than willing to help when we're fishing. You know, if you got questions, come up to us and ask us. We're more than willing to help you out too. So
how about for you, Lee? What is your best advice?
Well, like Chris said, you can't do better than local advice. What I would add to that is, as Chris was saying, we're very approachable. We try to be. So if someone's out fishing and they see a guy with the USA cap on, just ask us. We might even lend you some bait or swap you some bait, some artificial baits. We'll show you what we're doing. The only time we have any to hide is during a world championship, and that's because it's for national pride. Every nation wants to win. Other than that, I want to see people catch fish. I want to help people catch fish. And so I'm very happy to discuss what I'm doing, why I'm not catching, why I am catching, why we're catching different species. The key thing for anglers getting into street fishing, into urban artificial baits angling, is don't try and buy everything. Don't try and buy all the rigs and gear you need. Try a couple of things that local advice have told you works for your location and learn from that.
Well, Lee and Chris, go Team USA. All the best to you. Good luck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your support. And if any spectators want to come along and say hi, we'll be very happy to see them.
And that is Lee Young of Green Bay and Chris Ledvina of Shano. They are competitors in the 2025 Street Fishing World Championship in Green Bay, which gets underway next week on the Fox River.
We just heard about the growing interest in street fishing all over the world and here in Wisconsin.
And we want to know, where do you like to fish?
Is it grabbing your tackle box and dropping a line from a bridge or casting from a shore near you?
Is it in the middle of a calm lake on a crisp fall morning?
Or maybe you love ice fishing and dropping your line from inside your shanty.
Let us know about your favorite way to reel them in. Email us your story and about the one that got away at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
And thanks for sharing your fishing story. Even if you don't reveal your secret spot, that is okay. You could still hear your story on a future program.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Trevor Hook, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.